All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 13 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the Junior and Senior High. Today we're going to look specifically at the bridge between the modern world and archaic Egypt. Yesterday we talked about how modern Europeans created a science that overall it functions as the bridge between us and anything archaic. That science called archaeology. So we see, and I'll go ahead and use the chat here, we see that we have the word archaic and we also have the word archaeology, which obviously share the same root word. And archaeology developed first in Europe because of the interest of Europeans in the evidence pertaining to things like ancient Rome and ancient Egypt, the archaic period of Egypt, of Greek history. Did I say Egypt? I meant Greece. Including the archaic history of Greece, such as the Trojan War. And then there were also things in Britain and other places in Europe that really benefited from the use of archaeology, such as the Stonehenge monument in Britain and so on. So mostly it was focused on England at first, or the rest of Europe as well. But then, because of Napoleon, we start to have a connection between this development in modern Europe and what we call the Middle East today. Because without it, we'd be stuck in some measure, we'd be stuck with this over here being inaccessible. We wouldn't have a bridge that we could follow through to Menes-Narmer and to anything else going on in ancient Egypt. We'd be stuck looking at the artifacts that the Egyptians produced, and we just wouldn't be able to get past the basic language barrier, and thus we wouldn't be able to connect in a really deep, meaningful way with the Egyptians. Egypt would still be a fascinating place, absolutely. Here's Napoleon, who is going to be this crucial actor in so many historical senses when it comes to changing the world into the modern one that we live in. Here's another representation of him standing in front of a sarcophagus that's been uncovered by workers, and they have peeled off the wrappings of the mummy to reveal the very well-preserved corpse inside. I have no idea whether such an event actually took place. But back then they were certainly really looking at all kinds of different artifacts and wanting to see. And just fascinated by the mystery of it all. But that's just it. Archaeology is a form of, and here I'll type out another word because it's a very interesting word. Let me go to the chat window. Typically, archaeology is a form of what we call antiquarianism. There we go. Did I spell it right? Antiquarianism. It's in the chat box for anybody who's looking for it. And so antiquarianism is a kind of perspective, set of values which emphasizes antiquity. My personal view of history is the polar opposite. In other words, antiquarianism elevates the past to a value in and of itself. In my view, present centrism is really fundamentally the opposite view. That the past is not a value in and of itself, and that the proper reason to study the past is to better understand the world that we live in and live better in it. So this is, you know, antiquarians are, in some cases, there's kind of a mashing or a kind of cooperative thing that goes on between antiquarians and real historians, in the sense that You know, the antiquarians are so excited about the past all by itself, and they discover stuff. And then it really is the job of historians to measure the value of that, to weigh what the antiquarians are revealing to us, and then, well, then to reveal that and discuss that and teach that so that we can make the connection to the ancient past. So that's very much what we're doing here, right? We have Napoleon, he goes, conquers Egypt, he brings the antiquarians with him. They want to uncover the mummies, they just want to describe everything that they see, and for them that is the end of the, that is the goal, that is the purpose of what they're going to do. And then the historian's job is to take what they have revealed and then, all right, explain the significance, the relevance, the importance, if any, of this material. So, anyway, it's kind of a cool image. I don't know if it's not quite up to spec in terms of history through art, but it's still pretty neat. There's a lot of interesting art that has to do with Napoleon in Egypt. There's quite a mystique about his actions there. But anyway, so he goes to Egypt and he's able to, you know, be in charge there for about a year. And meanwhile, all his scientists and so on are working away at finding all the artifacts that they can and describing them and collecting them and creating kind of encyclopedias of all of the things that they are finding. But there's a really significant limit to what they can do with it until an artifact is discovered at a location which in English we call Rosetta. So, Rosie wants to chime in here, maybe because your name is so similar to the place. But let me just see. Let me get my... Oh, you're not raising your hand. You're accidentally raising your hand. I got to turn off the hand-raising noise, which I apologize. I didn't do before we started class. So let me go get rid of that annoying noise. And then Rosie, if you do have a question, I'll let you ask it or make a comment. So go ahead.
You accidentally raised my hand.
And that's an awful lot of accidents in a row. All right, see if you can maybe control that a little better. Okay, so Rosetta is the location here, which we're particularly interested in. I wanted to use this as an opportunity to discuss the geography of ancient Egypt and even modern Egypt. I mean, there is a certain significance and a similarity between these and the point of the geography map from week one, which I hope you've had a chance to kind of create for your own benefit. And I gave it to the high school students just as a handout here, is just to locate certain key places that we're going to be referring to so that it doesn't just, you know, have this a name, right? A place like Rosetta, if I say, okay, there's a stone, which we're going to look at, it's discovered in a place called Rosetta, then that doesn't mean anything to you, unless, of course, you know where that place is. So I wanted to label that particular important location right here. It's in a really remarkable spot. And this map of ancient Egypt that I gave you guys here is drawn in a way that's meant to represent the real limitations or kind of boundaries of ancient Egypt as opposed to modern Egypt. Nowadays, regardless of terrain, regardless of climate or anything else, you know, our modern countries often have these very linear borders out into the middle of nowhere, and, you know, claims of various countries are mapped out by geographers and stuff like that. And you see these very strange features that have nothing to do with nature, basically. They're just man-made, obviously. On the other hand, ancient Egypt was very much, the entire civilization was very much dictated by nature. It was a desert all around, and then this one lush corridor provided, you know, to human beings, basically, by the River Nile, like a lot of other civilizations, really primitive civilizations, We have the river, what we call river valley civilizations. They really depended on a river in order to provide water for agriculture. And they really were limited to staying inside of this corridor. And even to this day, this is really a significant factor in life in Egypt. I got some cool maps to show you about that. If we look at modern Egypt today, well, let me go to the full map for a second. Okay. This is a satellite map, and a satellite photograph of modern day Egypt. And you can see that green phenomenon that is highlighted on your geography map. The river, the Nile, runs through this region, but the Nile Valley, let's go in here now and zoom in. Okay, so look at this. See the blue thread is the river. And there it is down there, more visible than in other spots. Now, all of this really wide region is what we call the floodplain. The part of the river where, as we'll talk about in greater detail in weeks to come, where the river would naturally overflow following the rainy seasons. And then it would really kind of just flood that area. And then after that, you could plant crops there. And to this day, you can rely on kind of the ecosystem of that area there to provide for human life in a way that shelters it from this immense desert on either side. And yes, Keen asked, didn't they change the way that it floods? They absolutely did. It's completely different now than it once was in the past, because what you see right here is something called Lake Nasser, and this is a man-made lake. So they put in a giant dam called the Aswan Dam, which is what's labeled on your modern Egyptian, created this massive lake in order to control the river and use the water. And so they can pipe it and they can, you know, direct it for modern purposes. And so that kind of changes the nature of our ability to leverage the value of the water. So, going back to the total map here, just wanted to point out that Rosetta is up in this area. Let me zoom some more here. Okay. This is a remarkable place. This is just a fantastic, you know, natural haven for human life. This is called, I believe technically it's called an alluvial fan. Or just a simpler expression would be the mouth of the river, where basically the river has been carrying soil with it, you know, like, especially if you've been to seen the Mississippi or a river like that one that has a lot of mud in it. It's very brown and it carries all that mud down to the sea. And you can see, in some sense, what you're seeing here is the ocean, and the color of it is reflected in this soil that's being deposited. And eventually, the coastline will be here as the river continues to move the earth from down here over to the ocean. So rivers are massive transformative kind of entities in geography. And so this whole fan is possible because when the river hits the ocean, it stops and then it breaks off, and as the land is really flat here, it starts to break up into multiple channels. And so it opens up into the sea over here, over here, over here, over here, and basically all these spots. And so you get this incredible lush, you know, paradise basically right there. And that's where most of ancient Egyptian life was centered. So that's kind of the whole point of this map here, is to show, well, this is, you know, this was Egypt along the river. And then the massive fan, and that's it. All the rest that we think of really was, you know, had nothing to do with life there. It was a really small, very isolated, very concentrated kind of a civilization along the river. And last illustration that really is my favorite kind of illustration is the world from space at night. And this is awesome stuff. So this really dramatizes the role of the Nile in even modern Egyptian culture, right? Because you see the darkness of the Sahara Desert here, and then you just see this amazing tendril of light, of life, is basically what it is. You want to know where human beings are alive? You look for the light. And the more civilized a particular location is on Earth, the more light you're going to see emanating from it. And so this is just an incredible dramatization of the significance of the Nile in supporting Egyptian civilization. It's really the thing. It's absolutely spectacular when you take a photograph like this from space at night. All right, so anyway, that's just a little brief geography orientation. Rosetta's up here in near the mouth of the river, right, where it meets the sea, and that is where this particular artifact was discovered. Let me go to the full image of it. All right, so no doubt you have heard of the software program that's called Rosetta Stone. So if you want to learn Spanish or Mandarin or something else nowadays, you probably have got the homeschool version of Rosetta Stone installed on your computer. Why do they call their software Rosetta Stone? Well, they're getting it from here. They're getting it from the one and only. This object is literally a stone, and it is, when you say it's overrated, Timothy, I trust what you mean is it's not visually that stunning, but if you understand history, you can be more stunned, and so it is often the case that certain things are not as exciting, perhaps, as that sort of thing. But, you're referring to the software. I see. Okay. Well, anyway, let's talk about the stone. So, what did I want to say about the stone? I wanted to get my chat window back open here so that I could write a few other interesting vocabulary items. The Rosetta Stone is a stele, which is kind of strangely pronounced word. Is a flat stone surface, like this one, which you can plainly see. It was found, as Nemo has just chatted to that effect, by Napoleon's army. So he conquers Egypt in 1798, bringing all of these archaeologists with him. And they uncovered it while constructing a fort at Rosetta because their war was ongoing. It's called the Napoleonic Wars, and at this point it was still just before Napoleon had become the ruler of France. But before that, he is still fighting basically the English, and they're going to come, and eventually they're going to take it away from France. But they're building a fort because they intend to rule Egypt from now on. And so they're digging for that, to build that fort, and they find this stele. What's exciting about it is that it contains three different forms of writing. So down here we have ancient Greek script, the bottom one, and then you can see this band of empty space marking the separation. And then in the middle was another kind of script, which is called Demotic. I'll go ahead and chat that to you guys as well. So the middle script is called Demotic, and then the top is the famous hieroglyphics, which was, you know, the jackpot that everybody was interested in. This kind of script up here, the hieroglyphics, is the stuff that you find in the temples. So if you want to understand the pyramids and you want to understand the great temples, you got to be able to read this one. But what was interesting was, there were three forms of writing on here, which was kind of interesting. And this one here was easier to decipher. And the reason was that modern Egyptian script had derived from this. Modern Egyptian script was called Coptic. I'm going to show you a little translational key here, which is kind of interesting. And so if we go to Wikipedia concerning Demotic, yeah, you'll see that this is, I don't know, somebody put this together here just to give us some idea of how it works. Coptic meaning the more modern Egyptian script. And Demotic, you could see, was a script that obviously evolved into Coptic. So Demotic was kind of like a cursive form of writing. You can see kind of the smooth, you know, motions involved in creating the letters and so on. And the modern Egyptian script had evolved from that. So combined with the Greek, combined with an awareness of Egyptian Coptic writing, then you could piece together what the Demotic said. And just to give you some idea of the level of difficulty involved here, it took 15 years to do it. So it's not just as simple as looking at the symbols, because they have to pair you only get so much information from a document like that inscription on the Rosetta Stone. So you get some there, and then you have to compare that with writing in other spots and other documents that you can find in Demotic and so on. And you have to do a systematic, you know, construction of the symbolic code that's being used to represent the language and understand the meaning of it. And so it's a really tough job. It took about 15 years just to get the Demotic down. And then along comes a guy named Jean-François Champollion. So he is the French scholar who was responsible for finally cracking the code, for basically figuring out the most important elements of the hieroglyphics. So what Champollion did was he figured out, let's go back to this here, that hieroglyphic writing has certain patterns, recognizable patterns, that can be very useful in deciphering the meaning. In particular, scattered throughout hieroglyphic texts, whether they're in temples or on objects like the Rosetta Stone, you'll find something like this. And then if you look over here, you will see that exact same thing repeated. Happens to be slightly chopped off here, right, because it's broken. But it's the exact same symbol. And Juliet is right that this is called a cartouche. And what Champollion figured out was that the cartouche contains, here let's go to a dictionary definition of it. A cartouche is an oval indicating that the text enclosed is a royal name. So this was one of the crucial insights to unlocking the writing code, was to make the connection that this is a royal name and then just find out what the symbols are there and figure out what the name of the person would be. There would be, of course, you've got the writing in Demotic and you've got the writing in Greek, so you know it already. But what you can do then, once you know what the name is, well, then you know, well, how it's written in hieroglyphs. So now you're getting really close to, okay, how to parse out this strange language, which involves images, more like, right? It's not like an alphabetic thing. It's an ideographic, I believe is the name for it, type of languages, which like Chinese, is kind of similar to that, which involves a lot of images. So it's really hard to decipher, and he finally got it done by about 1822, was when, he published his paper explaining the decipherment of the Rosetta Stone. So what does it say? Why? What is the big deal? Well, it's the big deal is not so much what it says, but what it allows us to do. So the Rosetta Stone tells us about the reign of a pharaoh named Ptolemy the Fifth. And Egypt was ruled by a set of Greek rulers known as the Ptolemaic Dynasty. And Ptolemy, the P is silent, he was Ptolemy the Fifth. And so that means that his great-great-grandfather, Ptolemy the First, had become the first, basically Greek, or technically speaking, Macedonian. Macedonia was kind of a part of Greece. Ruler of Egypt. Ptolemy the First had been one of the bodyguards of Alexander the Great. And Alexander, as we'll learn when we study Greek history, had created a gigantic empire. It swallowed up all of Egypt. It swallowed up everything in between Greece and India. For a very, very brief period. And then after he died, his bodyguards and his, circle of generals split up the empire into a couple of different chunks, a few different chunks. And Egypt was one of the separate chunks, and Ptolemy became the first of its ruler. And so this is his great-great-grandson. And he is basically the stele, the Rosetta Stone, is celebrating his acts as a ruler. We probably, you could look at it a bunch of different ways. Ultimately, I think what you would say is that it's a document of propaganda, as people sometimes say today. In other words, it's a document that tries to promote the greatness of the ruler. Tries to convince people of the greatness of the ruler. What it says is, he's a very generous ruler. He gives tax breaks to the priests. He gives money for the construction of temples. He does the kinds of things that a great pharaoh should do by the standards of ancient Egyptian culture. So it's revealing of ancient Egyptian culture in part, at the time, at least at his time. And it basically just tells us a little bit of what Egyptian politics was like. And one of the things that it's written, the fact that it's written in three different languages is by itself interesting and very revealing about Egyptian society. If it was written in three different languages, what do you suppose that means? What does that tell us about the way life was like, at least by that point in Egyptian culture? It was written in 196 BC, or produced in 196 BC, so we're way, way down into the story. But what would it say about Egyptian culture that was written in three different languages? Kenny?
That there were several different languages that were in at least that area.
Yeah, right. That Egypt was a multilingual place. That Egypt was kind of a multicultural place. Just like today, if you go into a restroom today, you're likely to see signs in English and Spanish, right? And that just reveals the cultural mix in the country. And if you go into a restroom in Canada, you'll see signs in English and French. And that reveals the cultural mix there. Well, in ancient Egypt, at this time, you've got a cultural mix. You have a ruling class that speaks and writes Greek. Now, on the other hand, you have the native population, which writes and speaks Egyptian. But what the Rosetta Stone reveals in part is that there's no one language for Egyptian. Reveals something interesting about Egyptian society was it was very stratified or hierarchical. And the hieroglyphics were kind of writing for the elite members of society. They adorned the temples, and they were used by the priests and the rulers. And on the other hand, the writing that we see in the center strip, called Demotic, is very meaningful in that sense. The whole term Demotic, right, has the root word demos in it again, just like democracy. I'm chatting that to you guys. So the text in the center reveals that Egyptians used, in more common usage, they were not a literate society. No ancient societies were very literate, but there was a literate class of government functionaries and bureaucrats and administrators and tax officials and businessmen and merchants and so on. And all of their undertakings needed to be quantified and recorded and so on, as they have to be today. And so the Demotic script was the writing script of the people. It was kind of a cursive script. It was more useful. It wasn't this symbolic and religious language of the hieroglyphics. So then already, just by itself, the Rosetta Stone starts to tell us a whole bunch of interesting things about Greek society, or Egyptian society, and its connected Greek society at the time. But then beyond that, what it does is, it, of course, it links us to the rest. Everything else you ever wanted to know about Egypt, well, again, is revealed thanks to the translation key that you have. For instance, if you want to decipher this museum, what's going on, when it becomes a museum, what's going on in this temple, well, guess what you need to know? We needed to know, right? If we're going to have history, we need to know who. And so this is huge. Just understanding the presence of a cartouche and being able to decipher a cartouche is going to be huge for Egyptology. Because the cartouche gives you the name, of course, of the royal personage involved in any events. That's huge. So once you start to have that, and you can start to build a chronology of the rulers, you can start to build a history. So that's the significance of the Rosetta Stone, is that it just completely opens up this universe of writing, so that we can start to build a story of ancient Egypt, and we can connect to ancient Egypt. So that's our connection. And consequently, we need a new anchor fact. So we are going to take our timeline, right, which up to this point, like I said, it starts off, we've got this really strong connection and of a sort of a portal land chart that we've been building here, and we can trace that, and everybody here has done so very expertly in their writing, so that's a really good sign. You guys are comfortable with being able to move back and forth from the past to the present here. But the question that we, you know, need to have answered, and now we have a good answer to, is how do we make a connection to this? So that's what we're going to have our more developed timeline for from now on. And I was telling you about how, well, we've got these other civilizations, and they've all been linked together by Europe. And now what we're going to do is we're going to take this line, and we're going to be specific and precise about it. This line is this. So this dark green line, basically, is what's going to allow us to navigate. And what we're going to do with this is, I'm going to leave it up to you guys to decide at what resolution you want to model this particular fact. So, of course, I'm going to be providing you with this diagram, so you don't have to scramble to copy it or write it or anything like that, okay? But basically, and starting either tomorrow or Monday, I'm going to start giving you handouts just like this one, and we're going to start working on this diagram with something that we call is something that we call a fax practice. So what we're going to do is we're going to bridge this ancient Egyptian past in the following way. We're going to say, okay, we had Egypt, just like we had Athens and Rome, and then it fell. Well, over here we have the same phenomenon. We have the fact that the archaic culture disappears and is replaced. So we're going to mark that and say, okay, we need some additional, precise information in our minds in order to understand why should it be that, you know, for the longest time there was no connection and what the connection is going to be. It's because Islam comes in and basically this connection is severed. We don't have access to this anymore. Until such time as we get here. So what you're going to start off by doing in your own personal kind of characterization of this is I'm going to ask you to start with at least the Rosetta Stone and its discovery in 1799. If you're feeling as though all of this stuff is just easy to command, and I'm suspecting that everybody here is in pretty good shape with regard to these things, if you're getting all of these facts, which we're going to start practicing very soon and making sure that you're comfortable, completely comfortable with them, then what I'm going to have you do is I'm going to have you basically construct a bridge that is a little bit more articulate. Right? In other words, the anchor fact to archaic history is the Rosetta Stone, the discovery of the Rosetta Stone in 1799. But if you want to kind of tell the story of the Rosetta Stone and have a nicely articulate kind of version of it, I think what you need is a kind of three-part narrative. What you need is to describe that the French conqueror Napoleon conquered Egypt in 1798 and that it was his troops and archaeologists who discovered the Rosetta Stone in 1799, and finally that a French archaeologist named Champollion translated it in 1822. That's kind of a more high-resolution bridge between us and the archaic past. So you will have the option of how much you want to say, how much you personally want to remember about this. I'm going to insist on the Rosetta Stone. Okay, but I'm going to treat the rest probably as bonus points if you want to shoot for that as well. But basically that gives you this particular bridge. So what we do now in modern times, wherever we happen to be, anybody in the world has some measure of connection to ancient Egypt. And it comes because of this bridge. So it's quite indirect. See, we gotta go like this on our borderland chart. Or, you know, you could conceive of it perhaps in a slightly different way. Because of globalization, you can just say, okay, we're here. So because of our connection to Europe, we're going to treat it kind of more like this. Either way, both are kind of useful ways of thinking about it. But basically, if we don't have this bridge, we have no connection. We'll never know what this is, and we can't possibly care because we just will never be able to connect it. Okay, so now we have it. Now we have that connection. All right, so tomorrow what we're going to do is we're going to actually leap into this story here of, sorry, I can't highlight that very well, story of Menes Narmer. You know the anchor fact. Well, we're going to look at an object that's called the Narmer Palette. It is kind of, again, another really decisive archaeological artifact. And that palette is kind of, it's almost kind of like a history through art assignment to look at it and analyze it. It is a work of primitive art. So we'll see what the palette tells us about Narmer. And that'll be pretty much where this all ends up for us in terms of preparing for the test. Next week is going to be the test. So what we're going to do at this level is probably we're going to look at the Narmer palette, and then I'm going to assign you a second narration, which is going to be our connection to archaic Egypt, where again you'll have an opportunity to characterize the connection, to make sure that you can navigate from past to present and back, and then we're going to have a test. All right, so that's what's coming. Looks like we're going to finish a couple minutes early today. Hey, that's nice. All right, because that's all I've got, unless you guys got questions or comments. That's it for me. Abby, go ahead.
I'm sorry if I didn't catch it, but I didn't catch when the narration is due.
Oh, I haven't assigned it yet, so... So, which one are you referring to? Are you referring to the new one?
The one about the Rosetta Stone. I thought there was one about the Rosetta Stone.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, I'm going to give you a writing assignment on that. But I have not yet done so. So probably we'll do it today or tomorrow or Thursday. Okay?
Thanks.
All right. You bet. All right. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.